I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to The Connection. Our guest, research psychologist Clay Rutledge, wrote in a recent New York Times op-ed that the attention on mental health today is unprecedented. There are untold numbers of work and school programs, plus the proliferation of apps and public health campaigns, all aimed at getting us to better understand our inner lives. That has had the benefit of reducing the harmful stigma around mental illness. In fact, a 2025 study by the American Psychological Association found that an overwhelming majority of Americans, 88%, said that having a mental health disorder is nothing to be ashamed of. Rutledge sees a downside to all this focus on mental health, which he calls the pathologizing of ordinary life. Instead of feeling better about ourselves, he says that normal anxiety, stress, grief, and burnout are seen as a sign that something is wrong with us. A self-diagnosis becomes, in his words, a self-fulfilling prophecy. We asked Clay Rutledge to join us today on The Connection to explore the reasons for this phenomenon and what it reveals about our culture and ourselves. He's director of the Human Flourishing Lab at the Archbridge Institute. And Clay Rutledge, nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
Thanks for having me, Marty. It's great to be here.
Well, let's start with the good news and the fact that there is less stigma around mental health issues. What do you think has been the driver of this trend?
Yeah, and I think it's important to start with that good news. And also, there's other good news, too, which is, I think, in general, though there's still challenges for some to get access to good mental health care, it's certainly more accessible today than it was in previous decades. Stigma's down. And so I think there is a real a positive awareness that mental health is a real issue, that mental health is important for psychological flourishing, for societal flourishing. And so that is a trend towards human progress, I think. And as our societies have become more affluent and we're dealing less with issues like starvation, and, that we would have dealt with more in the past, we can pay more attention to our psychological well-being, which, again, is a sign of progress. So I think that's a great starting point.
Well, it's interesting to think that all the things that we've learned, and I do believe that we live in a much more of a neurodiverse world, that we understand mm-hmm. that there is great variation for all of us. I mean, everyone has, I think, a piece of perhaps a mental illness, if we want to put it that way, but that we're all struggling with how to live a good life.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and my background's in existential psychology, so the good life is very much at the core of what I'm interested in, and because humans don't just want to meet their physical needs and to feel safe, which of course is important, and to get plenty of calories, which is important, but we also are introspective. We have the ability, unlike any other organism, to turn inward and ask questions about the nature of our existence, why we're here, what our life is for, what's going to make our life fulfilling, what are our goals, what are our aspirations. And so human psychology is very important. Like our mental well-being is a very important feature of our life. And I think you're right. We're recognizing that more than ever. And we're recognizing, like you noted, the diversity of psychological experiences and vulnerabilities and challenges and opportunities that people have.
So why do you think more people are reporting the fact that they feel anxious or depressed? Where is that coming from?
So I think there's a number of possibilities. And to be clear, I don't think there's just one answer here. I think this is an important conversation to have because there are differences of opinion on this. But one thing that you will see get a lot of discussion is modernity. And so oftentimes when people see the rising rates of anxiety, depression, and related social issues that we wouldn't call pathological but are predictors or risk factors for mental illness, such as loneliness, people will say, well, we're more disconnected, we're spending more time on our phones, like we're consuming a lot of unhealthy content. And so I think there is something to that story as well. But what I focus on more is that in addition to that, and perhaps in part because of, we're spending more time on our phones, we're also in a way talking ourselves into being more mentally unhealthy. And mental illness is an interesting is unique in that you can't really talk yourself into heart disease, right? But you can talk yourself into depression because you can start behave thinking of yourself in ways in which you start to behave like somebody who's depressed, where you withdraw, where you become more passive, and that can actually put you on the path to developing depression.
Is that because, again, going back to our phones or our devices, that we can go on, let's say, TikTok, and some influencer is going to tell us that because we have these various symptoms, that that means that we are depressed? Is that what you're talking about?
That is a big part of the problem. There's a lot of mental health misinformation out there. And, for instance, there's been research showing that the more people use social media platforms for their information about mental health, the less accurate their knowledge is about psychopathology. And so, to be clear, there are good psychologists and good organizations that are putting out, useful and accurate information about mental health online. I think we have to be careful about, using broad strokes here and saying
Sure.
everything online is bad, because there's a lot of good stuff online for sure. But there is a lot of bad stuff as well. In addition to that, there's a lot of non-professionals or, kind of social media influencers who part of their platform is mental health, but they lack expertise. And, that in itself isn't the worst thing, because people can share their lived experience, of course, and sometimes that's useful. But what they don't often realize is they're normalizing, or they're engaging in a kind of almost glorification of mental illness as being an important source of identity. And again, research shows that the more you see a mental health condition as a part of your self story, as a part of your sense of identity, the worse it is for your mental health, actually.
You write that about a third of Gen Z adults. Now, Gen Z ranges from 14-year-olds to 29-year-olds, but we're talking about then young adults have given themselves a mental illness diagnosis. Does that mean that they say, I have depression, I am anxious? Are they saying that I am mentally ill, or are they saying, I feel anxious a lot. I'm depressed a lot? Because there is, at least in the psychological world, there's a big difference between a diagnosis and someone saying, I feel these particular symptoms.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you made that distinction. Yeah, so it does seem to be the case based on some of these surveys that they are saying, I have an anxiety disorder. And so, but I think that's part of the problem with the way we've expanded these kind of concepts, is because what they should be saying, or what many of them should be saying, is I often feel nervous or anxious, and that's I'm an anxious person, which is a personality, to your point, which can be a normal personality trait. Some people are just more prone to nervousness than others, but they're seeing that through the lens of psychopathology, and so they're saying, well, I have depression, or I have autism, or I have PTSD. I mean, there's a lot of different disorders in which were once we thought of as being really needing careful analysis to get a diagnosis. People are being a little bit more casual in how they use those terms in self-diagnosing.
Well, I wonder too, in the psychological world, there's diagnosis, but then it seems to me there are things like traits where you have things that look like depression or look like anxiety, but they're not the full-blown disorder or even diagnosis. How do you see that?
Yeah, that's correct. So, the biggest model of personality is called the Big Five. And, it breaks personality into five stable traits. And one of those traits is neuroticism. And neuroticism can really be thought of as trait level, or a stable level of negative affect or worry. So people who score high on neuroticism aren't ne don't necessarily have an anxiety disorder, right? But they're just the type of people that tend to be a little bit more worried. And if you have that trait, which is, perfectly normal, that does make you more vulnerable to certain things, whereas somebody who's low on neuroticism wouldn't be. But that's not the same thing as having a anxiety disorder. And so I think that that's important in a lot of ways. Another trait would be extroversion. So that's one that, you know, most people are familiar with. And so we don't say, oh, because you're low in extroversion, because you're an introvert, all of a sudden that you have some kind of mental health condition, for instance. And so I think that's an important distinction that you're making, is that there is a full range of psychological dispositions that people have that can be thought of as having both positives and negatives, having strengths and vulnerabilities. People hide neuroticism, more and more vulnerable to certain things, but that's not the same thing as saying you suffer from a diagnosable mental illness.
Because so many things are situational. I mean, there might be a situation where an introvert has more tools and skills than an extrovert. I mean, that they can shine under a certain circumstance, or someone even with autism has certain skills that someone who is not diagnosed with autism doesn't have. That situation matters a lot.
Yeah, definitely. Situation matters a lot. And the great thing about, you know, sometimes people will look at these stable traits that have, you know, a genetic proclivity, and they'll have a pretty fatalistic attitude about it. They'll be like, oh, this is just how I was born, and, you know, my life's, you know, I'm going to have all these challenges. But there's another way of looking at it too, which is knowledge is power. And so if you know you have certain if you know yourself, right, if you're like, this is the type of person I am, I tend to be more introverted, I tend to be more neurotic, then that's information that can help you shape those environments you're in, so that they're well matched, and you also know when to push yourself. So, for instance, you know, I consider myself fairly introverted. You know, my ideal time is by myself working. You know, I work by myself in my office, and I'm happy to spend the day writing or doing research or reading, and, you know, I'm perfectly fine with that. But I also know part of my job is, you know, doing things like this and talking to people. And so I think there are famous actors that are very, very introverted, right? And so, but they know this is something they do, and they have to develop these skills to go do the part of the job maybe they like the least, which is going out and promoting their movie and doing interviews and things like that. And so I think it's, or if you know you have a vulnerable, like a disposition towards addiction, for instance, that's very, very useful information about how you construct the environment around you to reduce the likelihood that you will be put into situations in which you'll have you will have challenges. So I think, I think this kind of information about yourself there's no reason to have a fatalistic view about it. It's more helping you shape the life that you want to live.
It's not written in stone. Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Clay Rutledge. He's a research psychologist and existential psychologist, director of the Human Flourishing Lab, and that's at the Archbridge Institute. And we've been talking about a piece that he had in the New York Times recently about the pathologizing of everyday life. We've got much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with psychologist Clay Rutledge. He's director of the Human Flourishing Lab, and that's at the Archbridge Institute. Wrote a book a couple of years ago called Past Forward, How Nostalgia Can Help You Live a More Meaningful Life, something that we will get to. Let me just pick up on a couple of things that your piece got me thinking about. And I wonder whether we live in a country that really prizes the individual, the survival of the fittest, let the strongest person win, and whether that helps explain the kind of loneliness that so many people feel. More people are living alone. There are fewer people that we interact with remote work and things like that. Whether we have a country that makes it harder to flourish, to use your words, and to be mentally healthy.
I mean, in some ways, I think it's true that we do rank as the most, if not as one of the most, if not the most individualist country. But more broadly, we're a very affluent country. And there is this interesting paradox with abundance, in that the more material wealth a society has, the less interdependent it tends to be. If you have the resources to pay somebody to do the things you want to do, or to drive your own car, or to live in a house by yourself, We often, as a society that prizes itself and people being able to pursue their aspirations and their dreams and live the lives that they want, it positions you well for that. And so, to our previous points about all the individual variety that people have, there's never been a better time for people with all sorts of different characteristics and traits and preference and interests to really be able to live the life they want to live. But on the other side of that, to your point, that also means we're less interdependent. We rely on each other less. We don't have to tolerate each other as much because we can say, well, I can just go do my own thing. I don't need you. And so there is something about that social friction of interdependence, about needing really to come together to solve problems that's good for us. That's good for our social well-being and psychological well-being. And so I think there is an interesting challenge of abundance. This doesn't mean that people want, this isn't like an argument against progress. This doesn't mean we want to go back to a time in which, oh yeah, we were very interdependent because we were poor, or because we had to work together to meet our basic survival needs. But it does create an interesting challenge of modern life where it takes a lot more effort and a lot more intentionality to be interdependent and to be there for each other. And so I think that's important. And it's very much what leads to a meaningful life is that sense that other people need you and you need them.
There's a lot of wealth, but it is not equally shared. We know there's this growing divide between the rich and the poor. I mean, the handful of rich people in this country have, more money than like a majority of the people at the other end. But one gets the feeling that many Americans feel as if the country is in decline, losing faith in the ability to solve our very difficult problems. Again, this rich-poor divide. Feels like there's very little social mobility for people at the lower end of the spectrum, feeling that the past maybe is better than what the future will be. But how do you see what feels like a kind of growing pessimism about the future of this country?
Yeah, that's right. There's definitely growing pessimism. It's well documented in a lot of surveys, including surveys we've done at the Archbridge Institute, and particularly so among younger generations. And what's interesting, in some ways, is it doesn't always break out. The pessimism doesn't always break out the way that you might think it would. Like, it's not always, for instance, the case that it's as simple as like lower income people are more pessimistic than higher income people. Sometimes it's, for lack of a better way of saying it, sometimes it's the more privileged, younger adults who are going to the most expensive elite universities that have the most pessimistic attitude about the future. So it's an interesting, there's something about to the previous topic about mental health, there's something about the environment and a culture in which pessimism, sometimes what we refer to as declinism, has become I wouldn't say necessarily the dominant, but a powerful cultural message for young people. And I think there's a lot of contributing factors, including issues like political polarization,
Right.
and the what we talked about before with social media. There's a lot of, if it bleeds, it leads, is the saying, right? There's a lot of negative content online. You don't often see the stories about what's going well, or the everyday successes that people are having, and the breakthroughs that are happening perhaps in science and medicine. What you often do see is the darker, more negative side of things. And so I think that, and it's accessible all the time. Like, it's not something you just see when you read the newspaper in the morning and then you go about your day. It's something that it's presented to you on your phone all day long. So there are a lot of factors going on here, but it's the younger generations that are the most pessimistic, which stands at odds with what you might expect of young people generally being more hopeful, more optimistic. They have their futures ahead of them. They feel agentic and inspired, and so that doesn't seem to be the case. Again, to be clear, there are young people that are very optimistic, but just generally speaking, they score higher on pessimism than older adults.
And I think there are a fair number of old people, if I can speak for them, that also have this sense of a kind of helplessness. I mean, seeing the problems, if you've lived a long life, you know that this country has gone through many difficult and dark times, but feeling as if we just don't seem to have the either leadership or the wherewithal to address what are so, there's the problems that are staring us in the face.
Yeah, this is, and a lot of Americans share that perspective, of course. I saw something the other day that about how more Americans identify as politically independent than identify with either party, for instance. So yeah, I think there's a general sense across the country of dissatisfaction with leadership, just being annoyed with our leaders' inability to come together and solve problems, especially on issues where there seems to be a general consensus. And so, yeah, I think that, you know, and I think that that's going on, and, you know, those are real challenges for sure. And then on top of that, there is something about, which I do think I do think there's a silver lining with the young people pessimism. It's true that they score higher on pessimism about the future than older adults, but there's also a number of trends that I think we're beginning to see in which young people are starting to feel more inspired and more energetic and are actually getting tired of the negativity that they experience in online spaces.
It's exhausting. Just one thing that as you were talking, I was thinking of the political polarization, and there's a couple, the Gutmans, who do a lot of work on couples and how they deal with conflict. And they learned that when couples have contempt for each other, there's a very good chance that that relationship is not going to survive. And I think there's a lot of political contempt in the land, you know, among people that look at someone with a different point of view and view them with contempt. And I think that's a very worrisome trend.
I totally agree with that. And, you know, and to be clear, like it's going to sound like I'm blaming the internet for everything, but I think one challenge, and I think the internet's wonderful and there's lots of great things about it. So I'm a big advocate for technological progress. But one challenge that I think helps facilitate or contribute to that contempt is a lot of times people are online and they're seeing things about people that they think they disagree with, and they're not actually talking to them in person. They're not getting a holistic experience with that person. And so any two individuals are going to have things that they disagree on, even big things that they disagree on. But if that's one thing and then there's 10 other things that there's commonality on, it's much easier to treat each other like real human beings and respectfully, and to understand that, you know, we're not always going to agree, but we can find common ground. And that's just much harder in this information ecosystem in which people are presented as very like simplistic ways of like, you're either on this side or you're on the other side.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and then we will talk about flourishing, something that you have spent your professional life looking at. And again, that's psychologist Clay Rutledge. He's director of the Human Flourishing Lab, and that's at the Archbridge Institute. His work is based on the belief in human potential and agency. What do you see, and how would you describe what it is, what it means to live a life that's full of flourishing, a flourishing life? What does that mean?
So I'm a big fan of the work of Viktor Frankl. And I think he had a big influence on my, you know, on my career as an existential psychologist.
Sure.
And a big part of that, I think, is this... is at the foundation of human flourishing is the notion that individuals, despite their circumstances that they find themselves in, have the ability to do something, right? To take responsibility for their lives and have that and have a responsibility, right? To themselves and to others, to live a meaningful life. And so even, you know, as you know, Frankl was, you know, this work was developed as he was in a concentration camp.
He was in Auschwitz. Yeah, he survived Auschwitz.
And so thankfully, most people don't have to be tested that way. No. But we all do have to deal with life's difficulties and including our inevitable mortality, right? You know, no matter how fortunate your life is, there will be challenges. There will be loss. There will be suffering. There will be pain. And so... At the heart of flourishing to me is the sense that not that you can avoid all that or that you can somehow life hack your way into a perfect life, but that you can, that you're resilient and you have the capacity to navigate these difficult challenges and to live a meaningful life. And if you start with that sense of agency, that doesn't automatically make your life great, but it helps build a foundation for flourishing, which really the Archbridge Institute, we think of flourishing in this holistic way, which is, you know, to a previous point you made about the challenges of a lot of people feeling like there's not social mobility. Economic flourishing is part of that
Sure.
story, which is you want people to not just be able to meet their material needs, but feel like they are making progress, that they're on some type of a path to economic security and fulfillment. But it's also social flourishing, right? We need relation. We know that humans are social. We need relationships. And it's not just that we need to be surrounded by people who are kind to us. Really, at the heart of a meaningful social life is the sense that people value you and that you matter. And this is why people can feel lonely even when they're surrounded by others. It's because other people aren't valuing them. People need a place at the table where they feel like they're an important contributor. And then you can go down the list: spiritual flourishing, cultural flourishing. And so, really, it's this holistic, multidimensional approach to. The good life is one in which we have these different dimensions of well-being, and people are able to use their agency and to, you know, and to create and support cultural ecosystems that support that for them.
Well, let me underscore the word mattering. I mean, we talk a lot about the importance of we're social creatures. We want to be in relationship with other people, and that's important and significant. But mattering, meaning that what you do makes a difference, either in your life or someone else's life, that your life has value, that really adds a whole other layer to how we think about social relationships and flourishing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think m mattering is the key. I think is the core ingredient of a meaningful life. So it's interesting because when, you know, I'm an existential psychologist, so I do a lot of, you know, I give a lot of talks and do a lot of interviews about meaning in life. And one common misconception that people have is that meaning is this philosophical endeavor in which you turn inward and it's contemplative and it's about like probing your inner self to, you know, to develop a philosophy of life. And I'm not saying there's no value in that, but it turns out really what meaning is, it's a more outward-oriented endeavor. You don't feel meaningful by sitting around and thinking deep thoughts. You feel meaningful by doing things in the world that matter. And so one of and this relates to the mental health issue. We launched this project called Head Out, which, you know, is at headoutworld.org if people are interested, but it really is about using meaning as a foundation for good mental health. And that means getting out in the world and doing things. And it turns out even, you know, whether someone suffers from depression or anxiety disorder or not, one of the best things you can do for your mental health and your psychological well-being more generally is to get out of your head and to go do things in the world. And so,
Like
for instance,
volunteering, for instance.
that's a perfect example. And studies have found that actually doing acts of kindness for others work as well or better than, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy exercises. Again, some people need the cognitive behavioral therapy in order to get into a place to where you know, good therapy often does that. It helps people get out of their heads and break the cycle of rumination. So, you know, again, I always try to be careful about this because I think sometimes people just jump in and they're like, oh, Clay's anti-therapy or, you know. No, that's not the case. The case is that for a lot of people, a lot of people don't actually need therapy because they don't suffer from a clinical diagnosable disorder. But even if people are getting therapy, good therapy, part of the goal is to break these unhealthy cognitive patterns and these cycles of rumination and to get you out and to do things. And so there's a lot of things you can, anyone, whether they're seeing a therapist or not, can do for themselves. And that's a big part of it. And that's at the core of living a meaningful life is if you're frustrated or you feel detached or lonely or you're pessimistic about the state of the world, you might not be able to change what's going on in Washington, D.C., but you can change what's going on in your community, in your life. And that actually puts you on the path to having a bigger impact, I think.
I wonder too, whether sort of, and this is, you know, taking a sort of a left turn here, but knowing that we're going to die, that we are mortal beings, you know, on this earth for a finite amount of time, whether that also helps us to sort of focus, or can help us to focus on, so how do I want to do this thing? How do I want to live my life? Who do I want to be? How do I want people to see me? How do I want to interact with the world? What do I want to leave behind? I mean, I guess these are these existential questions that, you know, hopefully can get us outside ourselves and into the world.
That's a great insight. I'm glad you brought that up, because that awareness of that uniquely human awareness of self and mortality animates a lot of human activity, I believe, because you're right. You do it when you feel like you have a limited time horizon and you're like, so there's one existential perspective that's a darker perspective, which is I'm just an insignificant speck of dust in the universe and I don't really matter. So what's the point? That puts you on a path towards depression.
Indeed.
to a previous conversation. And there's another, you know, a more positive look at that, which is because I only have so much time on this planet, and you know, I'm lucky to be here. I have an opportunity, and as Frankl and others would say, a responsibility even to live a meaningful life in which I do everything I can to make a positive difference in the world. And I really think that that's what most people are doing. And you know, to connect it back to the polarization issue and other societal challenges we face, I think if people could start with that, to be like, well, most people really are just trying to live, you know, fulfilling, meaningful lives. And there's a lot of disagreement. There's a lot of misinformation. There's a lot of problems. There's, you know, sometimes the disagreement's not even real. It's, you know, it's exaggerated. Sometimes it is real because, you know, we're just humans and there's a certain level of humility required. We don't have all the answers and everyone's trying to do their best. But if you start with that perspective, that most people all over the world, regardless of different cultures and backgrounds and religions and lived experiences, really are trying to live a meaningful life. And also, on top of that, from our research on meaning, we find that most people, regardless of their differences, what makes their life meaningful is actually quite similar, which is family, close relationships, and it's not distal things, it's proximal things.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Clay Rutledge, and we've been talking about living a good life, the fact that we are on this planet for a short amount of time. What are we going to do with it? Much more to talk about after this short break. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Our guest is existential psychologist Clay Rutledge. He's director of the Human Flourishing Lab at the Archbridge Institute. We began by talking about the pathologizing of everyday life. We were just talking about what it means to flourish as a human being, why mattering matters in our relationships. And now we are going to talk about nostalgia, something that Clay has written about. He wrote a book a couple of years ago, Past Forward, How Nostalgia Can Help You Live a More Meaningful Life. I was Googling nostalgia in preparation for the show, and it has a very interesting history. There was a Swiss medical student, I think this was back in the 17th century, who studied soldiers and nostalgia. They probably just wanted to go home rather than go fight a war there. But he called nostalgia a, quote, cerebral disease of essentially demonic causes. Another person theorized that it was the clanging cowbells of Switzerland that were making people nostalgic for home. In the 20th and 19th century in the United States, when there was this wave of immigration, there was something called the immigrant psychosis, which was their description of a kind of homesickness or nostalgia. Treatments included things like leeches and bloodletting. So I set the stage for the history of nostalgia. You have a very different and unique definition of how you think of nostalgia. I think of it as a kind of wistful feeling for the good old days, but you say it's more than that.
Yeah. And I love that history is so great.
Isn't
I
that a
mean,
wild? Like, who knew,
it
right?
is. You go from 1688 to your point when the term was coined to really represent a disease thought confined to Swiss mercenaries, that came down from the Alpine homes to fight in the plains of Europe, to the modern, to the modern day, which of consumer psychology, in which we think of nostalgia as something really fun and trendy, and it's trending right now a lot, for instance. And so it does have this really interesting history. Your sense that nostalgia is the sentimental or wistful longing for the good old days is correct. I mean, that part of nostalgia is what we call affect and desire. So there's this emotional or sentimental pull to the past. But then what that does is that helps bring to mind memories, autobiographical typically, but it turns out more broader than that. But historically, we've thought of nostalgia as this, these are your personal memories. And so that sentimental longing like helps bring them to mind. And then really it's that cognition, the memories, those experiences mixed with the emotion that create this interesting cocktail that has great psychological value and motivational power. So I think of nostalgia as the feeling mixed with mixed with these like cherished or special memories that we have for the past.
Let me ask you though about, because memory is so, or can be so unreliable. There are things from my past that I remember. I'll check it with my brother and sister. They said, Marty, that never happened. So our memories are, it seems to me, can be very influenced by the present, by our psychology, our own view of our own past. So how do we understand memory and nostalgia if it's potentially unreliable?
So yeah, nostalgia would definitely not want you would definitely not want it, nostalgic memories admitted into a court of law,
Indeed.
right?
Right.
Because there is you think of it almost like art. Like there is this creative component of nostalgia, which is you are pulling from memories. Typically, they're not just completely fabricated. There is something there, but it is more abstract. And it is shaped in this ongoing dialogue that we have with ourselves over the years. So you might have a memory of a time when you were a child that 10 years or 15 years later, you have a nostalgia for some aspect of it. It's not a totally accurate memory, but then 10 or 15 years later, there's something about it. As you've gotten older, as you've become a parent, or you've had some other life experience that makes that a different aspect of that memory relevant. And it's not so much the accuracy that matters as more of the like the wisdom or the inspiration you draw from it. And so I think what's interesting about nostalgia is, like I said, it's not something you'd want to use in a court of law because our autobiographical memories are very biased. But it is something in that ongoing relationship with yourself and your self story that I think nostalgia is particularly useful for.
Is it more the feeling, whatever the facts are, that there's a sort of feeling associated with that memory that is part of what nostalgia is all about? I mean, it is a warm, we tend to have a warm feeling about these memories
That's
for the
right.
most
Yeah.
part. Yeah.
Yeah. So nostalgia has this what we call a bittersweet characteristic, which is when people engage in nostalgia, they tend to report like a tinge of loss or sadness. And it's because typically you're nostalgic for things you miss. And that means you don't have them right now. You don't need to be nostalgic. If every morning you go to your favorite coffee shop and have a latte, you don't need to feel nostalgic for that because you're going to have that tomorrow. But if there's something that you feel like you don't have right now, so we tend to be more nostalgic for things that we're separated from in time and space. Our homeland or for a past, a relationship, a person that's no longer around. Just a vibe, even like a feeling that we had, and so we miss it. That makes us a little bit sad, but that we're still in contact with it, that we still have a relationship with this, brings us a smile to our face. And also, it's motive. I think one of the critical things, and this is why I called the book pa "Pass Forward," is it's motivational. So you might look back, as you get a little bit older, you might look back at a time and be like, you know what? When I was young, when I had these experiences, maybe the memories aren't accurate. But I do remember that feeling of adventure, of being bold, of the and I can I pull on that today? And I do this all the time which is, as you get old, you have your patterns, you get set in your ways, and there's certain benefits to that, of course. But then it's also useful to be like, well, I could change, I could do something different, and maybe there's something about the past that could be useful for helping me figure that out in the present.
How can we be, though, nostalgic for a time we never lived in, a place we've never been?
Yeah.
And that is a phenomenon.
Correct. Yeah. So we call this, or I call this historical nostalgia, which is feeling nostalgic for an era that predates you. And what I think is so interesting about that is, first of all, until just a few years ago, several years ago, you didn't really think about this type of nostalgia that much. We very much thought of autobiographical memories. You're nostalgic as from your own experiences. But we started to see all these indicators that people actually feel nostalgic for elements of the past that they couldn't have possibly experienced. And you see this, you've always seen this in some ways. Like sometimes people have a nostalgia for like a fashion from a particular decade
Sure.
or from an architecture style or a type of music or something. So we've always thought about this aesthetically. But more recently, we've really discovered that there's a lot of people that actually say that they have a nostalgic attachment to a particular time period before they were alive. And so then what that got really got us thinking was, well, humans are social, right? And we're cultural. And so just as we can use our own memories for inspiration and guidance nostalgically, perhaps we can exchange memories or exchange stories and cultural traditions and ideas with other people across time. And so there's an intergenerational component of nostalgia in which I can say, hey, I'm nostalgic for, certain elements of the, maybe the 1960s, and I wasn't born until 1976. And now what we're seeing is a lot of Gen Zers who grew up in the age of digital devices and streaming and online, always being online, are nostalgic for an analog past before they were born. And so, that is really interesting that nostalgia can extend beyond the self in a lot of ways.
Do you see a connection between nostalgia and stress? Because I think for some people, they are stuck in the past and they say, these are the good old days. This is where I want to live. I don't want to move forward. And I wonder whether living in a chaotic world, which we live in now, I think humans have probably always lived in a chaotic world, but it feels particularly chaotic today, that the tug of the past is a really powerful thing for an individual.
Absolutely. So it's definitely true in our nostalgia research that we've found. We've been doing nostalgia research for over 25 years now. And a common thing that we find is though nostalgia can be triggered by all sorts of things, including just hearing an old song or running into an old friend, the most powerful trigger of nostalgia is negative affect, including stress and anxiety. So typically, what happens is when people feel dissatisfied in some ways, or frustrated, or stressed, or anxious in some ways, they tend to become nostalgic. That's a trigger of nostalgia. And exactly to your point, it's a stabilizing force. So when the world feels uncertain and chaotic and overwhelming, we often look to the past because we've had time to make sense of our past and to tell our story of a past. And so we've had time to extract the life lessons from different experiences we've had over the years. And so even negative experiences from the past can actually be a source of nostalgia if they signal some sort of triumph over adversity or resilience or like a life lesson. And so we definitely use it to stabilize. But in addition to that, I think it's something that's important that we've distinguished more recently is that there's a difference between what we'd call a healthy nostalgia, which is, what we've been talking about mostly, which is this sense of I can use the past in a way to help me grapple with the challenges I'm facing today and even inspire me. But that's different from what we call declinism, which is the sense that the world was better in the past and there's only one direction, and that's things are going to get worse. And it turns out that's unhealthy. And so there's the warm feelings we have for the past are more positive and good for us and for society than the idea that the world's just getting that declinist attitude would.
How do you see MAGA, Make America Great Again? Because that certainly is, I mean, it's a the movement, such as it is, that is following President Trump, that believes that there was an America that is much better than the America of today. How do you see that?
I see it as largely a declinist movement, I think. And, so to be, again, like so many other things, there are all sorts of different perspectives, I'm sure. And I'm sure there are there are optimists and people who look to the future with hope, who would maybe describe themselves as being MAGA. But I think as a political message, it's a very declinist perspective, and not a particularly healthy perspective. I think it's political nostalgia and cultural nostalgia more broadly is something that politicians of different across the aisle have used in positive and negative ways. But whenever, to me, when you see any kind of movement, and we're seeing this on the far right and on the far left too, if you see any kind of movement where the idea is like, well, the past was better than the present, then that's it, and it's presented as kind of a zero sum sort of perspective, then I think that's unhealthy. I think a better response is to say, well, there are aspects of the past that maybe would be that we did some things better, or there is something that we've lost or forgotten that would be useful for today, whether that's in our relationship with nature, which you often see more on the left, right, which is we've forgotten how our connection to nature is important, or you maybe how we spent more time together as families and did things together. Or, I mean, there's definitely things that can be used from the past in a useful way that don't require you to say the past was better and the present is bad.
I'm thinking of healthy nostalgia, just to underscore that, which sounds like what you're saying is, yes, we can savor the past, we can, enjoy the memories of the past, but we don't necessarily want to live there. We want to live in the present
Right.
and focus on the future, but hopefully draw on some of the experiences and things that we've learned from the past. And it seems to me that's kind of what therapy is about, which is, trying to figure out what is it about where I came from that has made me the person I am today, and how do I want to change that story? Maybe based on things in the past, but how I can build a different story for the future.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what I think before when I talked about nostalgia, I brought up the term creative process, and I think that's part of it. And I don't mean creative in the sense of like made up. I mean creative in that it involves a certain level of imaginative thinking and flexibility and problem solving. And I think that nostalgia can help us do that when used in that more healthy way, because it's not about like, oh, I want to live in the past, as you pointed out. When people say that, you can poll people, and there's surveys showing that like a high percentage of Gen Z will say the past was better than the present. But if you really start to ask people more specific questions, like would you give up the social freedoms and civil liberties that people have today to live in this supposed better past? Oh, no, of course not. What about the medical? What about the medical treatments? Or even in technology, even young people are frustrated with the social media. They still want their smartphones. They still want the Uber app, right? They still want Spotify. They still want ac the access to information and entertainment that technological advances provide. But what they're saying is there's something unhealthy about their relationship with technology, and they want more balance. And I think that's a lot of what this nostalgia is, and it can be twisted in po for political or ideological purposes, as you were pointing out with some of the MAGA stuff. But it can also be used in a way to pull inspiration from aspects of the past that maybe we think are useful that we have forgotten or that we've neglected.
We're almost out of time here, but I do need to ask about the video game console that you have behind you, Clay. What's your game du jour? What are you playing there?
So that it's called Robotron. It's a pretty obscure game from the 80s, but like most nostalgic memories, it actually has a very social story, even though it's an electronic device, which is I have a good friend who rebuilds our old arcade machines, and his take on it is there's all these old video games that brought people a lot of joy, and they've been neglected or forgotten, and they're just piled away somewhere, and he likes to rehabilitate them and bring them back to life. And he made this machine for me. He fixed up this machine for me, and I just thought that was just such a great encapsulation of nostalgia, which is it's not about living in the past. It's about reviving, reutilizing, and improving aspects of the past to make them relevant and useful today.
Well, we have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
Thank you, Marty. It was great to chat with you.
Yeah, we covered a lot of territory. And again, that is research psychologist, existential psychologist, Clay Rutledge, director of the Human Flourishing Lab at the Archbridge Institute. And again, he did write a book a couple of years ago about nostalgia called Past Forward, How Nostalgia Can Help You Live a More Meaningful Life. And thank you for joining us today on The Connection. You can check us out on Facebook. And also check us out on Instagram, leave us an email, and sign up for our newsletter. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of the show. Debbie Builder produces The Connection. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks so much for joining us.